the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina. It's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax. But buckle up and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
Welcome to another edition of Civitalk. Today, Brooke and I are going to look at the North Carolina primary results and focus on a lot of political aspects. But before we do that, we have a new side project at the Civitas Institute, a book club. Brooke, what do you think about this? Bob has been, Bob Lupke, our director of policy, has been big on forming a book club. So we have something to talk about on the side that's, unrelated to North Carolina politics.
I think it's a wonderful idea, and I am already feeling this much more like intellectually hefty as a result of us just even talking about having a book club. So very excited about
it. I'm not going to throw this individual under the bus, but they brought several liberal books to the table at the meeting. So.
Not me. It was not me.
I'm just going to float that out there and let listeners figure that out for themselves. So
there was someone in the group that brought a few book suggestions, and I mean, we might as well have been reading Das Kapital.
I'm exaggerating a little bit, but it was kind of funny that this person, won't name the gender, did kind of at the beginning say, look, these are going to stretch our preconceived notions or our preconceived biases. And so actually I think that's helpful. And I thought the books that they suggested were very good.
Well, I mean, I guess if you're into leaving your echo chamber every once in a while.
Right.
Yeah, actually, I'm super excited about this book club, though. I have long wanted to be a part of one. I actually started a couple of Facebook groups over the years. One was a book club specifically around a parenting book. So me and several other friends did that. And then I started a different book group where we just shared what we were reading. We weren't all required to read the same thing. We just wanted to kind of share our mutual love and appreciation for books. And so now to have one in the office where all I have to do is walk over to the conference room to be able to discuss something that we're all reading really excites me, especially because there will be snacks, I think, right?
I hope so. But yeah, I'm excited too. I love to read. It's been a little bit challenging because I've been such a vociferous reader my whole life. It's been a little bit challenging with a 1 and 3 year old to try to keep up with my reading pace, and you really can't do it. But I do love to read, and I'm constantly reading several books at the same time.
Yeah, well, and even with 2 toddlers in your home, you still read more than almost anyone else I know. So
yeah, I try to stay up late, and it probably drives my wife crazy, but I will stay up late if I have a really good book and just continue to plow through at the expense of everybody else in my life. So that's,
you know, it's all about trade-offs, Ray.
Right. So let's jump into this North Carolina primary. I want to ask you, Brooke. I wrote a short piece about just sort of the wrap up, but what were your big surprises? And we had a Civitas poll here that really tracked this thing very accurately compared to some of the other polls that were out there, especially compared to some of the other polls out there. So we should give ourselves a pat on the back for that.
I was running like internal victory laps in my mind. I was so excited about just how accurate our poll was compared to the others when it came to predicting Biden's huge win. We have endeavored since the beginning of the poll, but I can definitely vouch for it since I started at Civitas and have been part of these meetings about what we're going to poll. But it has always been a desire of ours to really be top notch in terms of how we ask the questions and making sure that we're not guiding the
absolutely. Yeah, it's important that we have a good reputation. And it's always funny when you see on social media, you know, people who are against us for whatever reason, but they're like, oh, that's a Civitas poll. You know, they say, why do you trust that? It's a Civitas poll, but we're using the
same questions
and methodology of other professional pollsters. There's no slant to it. We're not calling our friends. We're not calling our supporters.
Well, it is funny because I don't think there's a broad understanding of how polls work. And part of that is just because it's so wonky and there's a lot of, you know, weeds to kind of wade through when it comes to it. But Leah Byers, our policy analyst, has written a couple of pieces mm-hmm. just explaining how polls work and just doing like a really basic explainer guide. So if you want to go to our website and check that out, just use the search function at the top right hand corner and you can find out. Or send us an email at radio@nccivitas.org, and I will send you a copy of that. But yeah, so that was one one big takeaway from primary night, though, was just how our poll was able to really, you know, zero in on what looked like was going to be a big night for Biden and turned out to be the case. But I think some of the other noteworthy wins on Tuesday. Well, one of them, which most people won't actually even be aware of, but I think it's worth noting, is the state auditor's Republican race. It was between Anthony Wayne Street and Tim Hogemeyer. But days before this this election, it came out that Anthony Street had been arrested several times, convicted once of stalking, and yet he still won this race because people aren't reading the news. And so he won, I think, by about 56% of the vote.
So you don't think most North Carolinians were pro-stalker?
You know, I would have a problem having my state auditor be someone that was convicted of stalking. I'll be honest.
No, I think it's a credible apprehension for you to think that.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, just something about that doesn't scream trustworthy to me. So, but he will be running against Beth Wood, who is the Democratic candidate and current state auditor. But I'll tell you what, Beth Wood has been doing a very good job, I would say, when it comes to just exposing some of the Medicaid fraud that happens in our state.
She has done a good job with that. And so, yeah, she should get props for that. And I don't know who I'm going to support. So I don't know if I have much to add for the state auditor position, but I do think that it's an important position for sure. I mean, having lived in Mississippi for a while where you saw a lot of corruption, more so than some other states, especially with government officials, I do know that the state auditor is a very important job. And if you have someone who themselves has some ethical issues or are corrupt, then that's not a good thing.
Agreed. So what were some of the big takeaways for you?
Yeah, I wrote... I think one of the big takeaways that was not a surprise to me, but when people look at the presidential race, and I talked about this, I don't know if I wrote anything about this at Civitas because, you know, it's more of a partisan take, but I thought that Michael Bloomberg would not do well, and maybe he overperformed in our own poll just a little bit, but just nationally and in North Carolina, he didn't really do that well, even though he sunk a bunch of resources into this state. I've always felt, Brooke, that he was a flawed candidate, despite the money. I thought the money would be no help to him. There's been plenty of examples of rich people who have run for president that have not done well. Ross Perot, he did well in the sense that he was an independent, but he wasn't able to really harness a lot of his wealth to really, you know, win the presidency, so to speak. And you had Michael Huffington, who was a famous senator or a famous candidate in the 1990s, who was previously married to Arianna Huffington. Some people won't know that, but he was a rich, closeted gay Republican. And he ran and almost beat Dianne Feinstein. He spent a fortune, but still lost out there in California before it was completely toast ideologically out there. So, you know, I knew that there was an example of rich people not being able to perhaps connect with the electorate, but also underperform. And it didn't really surprise me because one thing I've always stressed about Michael Bloomberg is I don't think he resonates with a lot of people because, look, he's trying to be a bully himself to some degree. And... he's a rich white guy, and the Democrats seem like they're against that, you know, and a lot of the things that they say, a lot of the things that they go out and trumpet when they're out campaigning, their identity politics. And to me, it made sense why he was rejected. And I think the big reason is he just doesn't come across as likable.
No, he doesn't. I mean, he comes across as very autocratic, and I think rightfully so. I mean, when you're banning sodas and you're after people's guns, it's not going to sit well with a number of Americans, including a number of Democrats that are gun owners themselves. And so, yeah, Bloomberg, his campaign did a good job of trolling President Trump on Twitter, and then Trump would come back and like one-up him. And so that was entertaining in terms of the entertainment value that was there from Bloomberg. But if you are a party that really has a problem or has tried to demonize old white men, then if you're going to be an old white male candidate, you have to be very humble, I would say, or downplay your old white maleness.
Right.
And Bloomberg didn't do that.
Well, Trump had a funny line on the Bloomberg thing that I thought was funny. You know, sometimes we wince and we grimace when we see Trump on Twitter. But when he said that Bloomberg spent $550 million or a little over $500 million in this campaign and all he got was the nickname Mini Mike, I thought that was kind of funny.
Oh, yeah. I'll tell you what. Yeah. Mike Bloomberg's campaign, as like trollish as they were trying to be, I'm like, you're not going to out troll the like troll master. So that, yeah, that was funny. But another Super Tuesday win that you wrote about in your article that's on our website, but also you, I think, covered this with Tyler Crowley on his radio show this week, was Mark Robinson's big win for lieutenant governor.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, Brooke, how you felt about this lieutenant governor's race, but I looked at it and, you know, I have no idea who I would have supported, at least, you know, weeks ago. I kind of did a little bit of research and figured that out, but I had no idea with some of these candidates, even though I'd heard of half of them. There were some that I just ruled out automatically, but I think a lot of people felt that way. And so you had a guy like Mark Robinson, who anybody in this state and really maybe even nation, because the way his viral video just exploded when he went to, I can't remember if it was a Winston-Salem city council meeting where he went and spoke about the Second Amendment because they were planning on doing some kind of banning of firearms or trying to pass some kind of ordinance. And he gave a speech that just really galvanized a lot of people in the gun movement, got them excited. Obviously, he's a bright guy and articulate and was able to express himself in a passionate manner. And that just really got people across the state excited. So when you looked at this whole list from lieutenant governor, it made sense the more I thought about it, why he won, in the sense that I don't think these other candidates, Brooke, really offered a lot to people. They didn't have a lot of money to spend. They didn't really have, you know, outside of a few, huge name ID, but Robinson had a big name ID and he comes across as likable. And in this environment, it's good not to be a career politician, I think. And, you know, he benefited from all that. And, it, you know, the more I think about it, it makes sense. You know, I thought there'd be a runoff like most people, but I always thought Mark Robinson would be in it and it makes sense why he kind of won to me.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. Now, let me ask you this. Do you think that there is more of an anti-establishment strain in the Republican Party than in the Democratic Party? Now, hear me out first. The answer might seem really obvious to listeners, but I'm just thinking about how the Democratic Party is now evolving as well. And Bernie Sanders is still a formidable candidate. But which party do you think has more of an anti-establishment populist fervor to it?
Ooh, that's a good question. I mean, those I would parse those out a little differently, because I think the populist side, you could argue either way, you know, which side, because I think with the economic arguments, the populist side, the Democrats have carried that mantle for a long time. Republicans more recently to some degree under Trump, but I would probably say the Republican Party, but I think we have to think of it differently too, because look, I mean, Sanders in some ways, even though he's been a part of the establishment for a long time in the sense of he's been a creature of Congress and the Senate, although he hasn't really accomplished anything there, but he's caucused with the Democrats forever and he's been a creature of Washington forever. But he's anti-establishment because he's an independent and he rails against his own party. I mean, even though he's not a Democrat, but he's caucus with them, he rails against the Democrats. So it's hard to say for sure, but certainly the Republicans a little more today. I will say this for the Democrats. I think their sole focus more is about defeating Trump, and that's why I think you see Biden surging at this point. But yeah, I would say Republicans overall are probably a little more anti-establishment now.
Yeah, I think, you know, that famous line that continues to be a rallying cry for many is drain the swamp. And I think that that's kind of the most colloquial way you can say it in rural America and in the Rust Belt areas. And certainly.
I'll just bring up one point about Mark Robinson, which people, how many people, Brooke, do you think, because I actually went and researched after he won the primary. I didn't go to his campaign website before, but how many people think they know, you know, what issue Mark Robinson is, despite, you know, outside of gun rights, that mm-hmm. voted? How many people do you think went in there knowing what his position on abortion was, what his position on trade was, and these other positions? Do you think many at all?
No, yeah, no.
I didn't know, and I followed this stuff, and so I went to his website, and I was fascinated by some of his positions. Some of his positions are certainly more protectionist when it comes to trade. He's certainly pro-life and talked about – he actually had a really good couple lines about I think he was a 8th of 9th child or something, and talked about the importance of life in his family unit and wow. family dynamic, which I thought was really passionate. But yeah, kind of on trade, he is positioning himself more in the Trump camp and was downplaying trade agreements and talked about how in his own life he lost a job to NAFTA. And he was much more protectionist, it seemed like, on his campaign website on trade.
And I think we're going to see even more of those kind of positions, like policy stances, going into this election. It is something that is becoming more accepted among the Republican Party again, I think. And there was that history better than I, but I mean, I think that was something that was in existence, a sort of protectionism long before. But when there was that Cold War coalition and there was the classical liberals that joined with the traditional social conservatives, there was a good push against this sort of economic protectionism that we're seeing resurge again. And so I wonder, like 4 years in 2024, if the trade policies of the Republican Party are going to look totally different than they were in 2016.
Yeah, and they might actually correct themselves back to more recent history for the Republican Party.
That would be nice.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you're certainly a free trader, you would certainly want that. But you're right. I mean, you got the history right. Republicans traditionally, especially in the early part of the 20th century, were the protectionist party in the even into the Gilded Age and certain aspects of American history, Republicans were much more protectionist.
Yeah. So I've been reading a book and it's been taking me forever because I'm not as fast of a reader as Ray, but it's been really good. It's called The Conservative Intellectual Movement and it's by George Nash. And it talks about the history of conservatism starting around the end of World War II. It goes a little bit before that, but then carries it into modern day. And it's just really helpful in understanding the various coalitions that have been built over the years. And I think that helps us better understand the moment that we are in right now and where conservative intellectual thought is headed. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Interesting stuff. Yeah. But hey, also, Andy Jackson, our election policy analyst, he is being put to work like nobody's business this election season. He has just kind of kept his finger on the pulse of just so many different aspects of elections across our state. And North Carolina is not only a battleground state, but we have numerous redistricting cases before the state and national Supreme Courts, and there's just a lot going on. But as our audience knows, voter ID is at the top of Andy's list of focus areas, and he's very proficient in it. So let's talk a little bit about voter ID because it's still working its way through the courts and it's still very much a political battle.
Yeah, it's frustrating to me from a constitutional perspective when you have voters go out and pass fairly overwhelmingly, even though all the money that was spent against it. I don't think there was much money, you know, spent in favor of voter ID, but there was tons of money, and I don't remember the exact figures spent against voter ID. But you have a constitutional amendment that's passed by the voters, yet the courts can come in and just, you know, invalidate that. When it's especially frustrating when you have 35 other states with some other form of voter ID. So to me, I mean, it's just the erosion of you know, this democracy, this democratic ideal that the legislature represent the people and the voters have an ability to amend their constitution without the courts totally infringing on their right. And so to me, it's just frustrating, Brooke. I mean, we've had so many things. The judicial activism in North Carolina seems to be much worse than many other states.
And, oh, heavens, yes.
I mean, it's just frustrating because I come from other states where they were able to accomplish this stuff very easily, even when something wasn't bipartisan, especially right. when you have the people validate something the way that they do. And then you have the courts in North Carolina constantly swooping in and validating stuff. And to me, that's the most depressing thing of all, because really what you're doing is giving the courts the power of government and taking away from the people and the legislators.
That's it in a nutshell. And so ruling through these judicial fiats, essentially. But, you know, we have 35 other states in the U.S. that have passed voter ID legislation. And yet we continue to fight this battle. And those that are opposed to voter ID usually fight it on this racial or along the racial lines. And it's just a shame, because this is simply a very common sense, straightforward election security measure that can that is just one tool among numerous options that, like, we need absentee ballot reform, for example, if we're thinking about Bladen County and that election fraud that occurred there. But it just makes sense. Yet we continue to fight this battle, and oftentimes to conjure up these sort of racial animosities that have existed for so long. That's what the left is relying on when it comes to the voter ID argument. And so it stokes a lot of fear in people if they're not really sure exactly what voter ID means and how it can help protect our elections.
That's a great point. And I would just love to get a big win here on voter ID, because it's long past time. I mean, we've been fighting this battle in North Carolina for a decade at least, it seems like. And it's just time to validate what the voters want in this state and stop playing games, political games. Andy's written so much on voter ID. I don't know what else I can add. I mean, I would just encourage people who are really passionate about this issue to go to nccivitas.org and read some of his articles, because he's really been the expert and focused on all the intricacies of voter ID. And, you know, I don't always understand some of the court decisions and why they're deciding the way that they are, but it's an important issue, because when you have the courts invalidating for what seem like just political reasons, they're not doing it to trumpet rights of citizens. It's obvious to me what they're doing is because, you know, a certain party in the state wants to hold power, and they think that which there's no evidence to this, but by implementing voter ID, that's going to, you know, negate their chances of winning back power. When, look, I mean, you've passed voter ID in every southern state has some form of voter ID now, and African American or Black voters have increased their participation. So the evidence is all to the contrary, Brooke.
I know it is. And so there's no good reason. It is political, like you mentioned. And I would just add one more thing. It's to me, for Governor Cooper to veto the implementing legislation for voter ID after the people were so clear, the voters were so clear what they wanted. That's voter suppression to me. That's what I see as voter suppression, not asking someone to prove that they are the person they say they are so that they don't take a vote from someone else. That's not voter suppression. So we could talk about that for a while, but you just should go to our website and read up on it, because I feel like Andy will explain it even far better than us. We're just giving you sort of the 30,000 foot view of it. But if you really want to dig in, check it out at nccivitas.org. But one more thing, Ray, what's going on with the stock market? I see the Fed's cut rates, which was something they hadn't done since, or at least cut to this degree since 2008. But then the stock market tanked again today.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's a lot of fears around the coronavirus that it's going to temporarily shut down or really limit the economic power of the U.S. Obviously, all countries to some extent are going to be dealing with that. But if the U.S. is shut down, or large segments of our economy are shut down, then that's going to threaten the markets, and people are reacting to that. I would remind people that especially if they're younger or they have a few years to retirement, stay the course. That's been the advice of some of the great financial advisors like Jack Bogle of the Vanguard Group. Stay the course, stay invested, because it's a good time to buy now. And it's a good time really just to figure out what your asset allocation is and just stay the course. And I think that's always good advice when it comes to investing or staying involved in the market. There's always these things that are scary, but I always think it's better to be in the market and than not to be in the market and to stay invested, because the long-term gains have been proven over and over again that you will make out well. Don't sell everything you have and basically lock in your losses and buy gold. I've seen people do that, so I would advise against that. But, you know, obviously.
Agreed. Don't panic.
Yeah.
That's it. Don't panic.
But, you know, people are going to do what they want to do sometimes, and you can't stop them.
Yeah, we're far more motivated by fear. It's sort of our survival instinct, and it can be a good thing sometimes, but in other cases, it's just because it's our initial reaction doesn't mean it's the right reaction. And so certainly in the case of stock market ebbs and flows, I think we need to use some wisdom and practice that wisdom of the ages, which is, yeah, just sit back for a little bit, let things ride out. This too shall pass.
And plus, Trump promises great stock markets. So, I mean, what's
so there's that too.
Yeah, I mean, winning, constant winning and record highs. So just cling to that, I tell people.
Cling to that. Right. I think there's some other things we should be clinging to, but we will leave that for now. It's been a great episode, Ray. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
You guys have a wonderful week, and we'll talk to you later.